My name's Fran Bennett. I'm a senior research and teaching fellow at the Department of Social Policy and Intervention at the University of Oxford. I'm joined today by Sir Tony Atkinson, who's a fellow of Nuffield College, also at the University of Oxford, and a centennial professor at the London School of Economics. We're hosted by the Oxford Martin School, where Sir Tony is senior research fellow at the Institute for New Economic Thinking. He's also the author of a new book published by Harvard University Press called Inequality, What Can Be Done? And that's what we're going to be talking about today. Tony, you set out to argue against the view that inequality doesn't matter and that even if it does, little can be done about it. And in fact, Brian Nolan, when he was commenting on your book, called you the godfather of inequality economics. So I wanted to focus on the core messages of your book rather than the detailed facts and figures. And I wanted to focus in that order. In other words, inequality doesn't matter is the first thing you're arguing against. And the second thing is that even if it does, little can be done about it. So in terms of arguing against inequality not mattering, you're focusing on economic inequality in particular. And you talk about the reasons for concern about inequality. Those are instrumentalist, but also intrinsic. So I wondered if you could say a little bit about why we should be concerned.
I think the reasons for concern are indeed sort of twofold. One is the consequences of inequality, which mean, in fact, that economic advantage and disadvantage spills over into many other aspects of our lives. So it, in fact, takes us beyond simply the economy. So that, for example, people are concerned about the impact that large concentrations of wealth have on, for example, our political lives and the control of the media and other things, where it goes far beyond just talking about supply and demand. I think there are other reasons where some people obviously are concerned, including some of our world leaders, with the effect that it has on the way the world economy is working. The head of the IMF has been concerned about the implications for the stability and sustainability of the world economic system. It's also, I think, closer to home. I think it's very much a matter concerned with perhaps a sort of broader notion of inequality of opportunity, which I think many people, even those who are from all parts of the political spectrum, say they're concerned about inequality of opportunity. And one of the things I argue in the book is that, fully sharing that, it's quite difficult to have inequality, to have equality of opportunity if you have large inequalities of outcomes.
Yeah. So that was about the concern about inequality, but the core of the book is really practical policy proposals. And so I wanted to go on to talk about those. And they might be seen as the kind of proposals where if you were in Yes, Prime Minister, the civil servant might be saying, this is very brave, Prime Minister. Because you have quite radical, I think, policy proposals in a range of areas of policy, which I wanted to talk about a little bit. Perhaps to begin with, your proposals on taxation, perhaps you could tell us a bit about those.
The range of proposals I put forward is indeed quite a wide one. And I think that's, in fact, one of the roles of academics is actually to enlarge the debate. I think it's natural for perhaps politicians to want to focus very much down on their own particular ambitions and concerns. But one of the things I think that as an academic standing outside one can do is to say, well, actually, there's a much larger range of choices that we can think about. And things which may appear off the agenda should perhaps be brought into public discussion. So, for example, I mean, I think in discussing taxation, an obvious example would be the way in which we tax property, local property, through council tax, which is a particularly British phenomenon. But if one just steps back and thinks about how we've reached that, we realise that we've actually reached it by changing the whole basis on which we tax on a local basis, which is we've switched from people being essentially taxed on their ability to pay, which was the old basis, which went on for decades, if not centuries, to one which was, in the form of the poll tax most acutely, was a tax on the supposed benefits people get from local government. And I think that if you then reconsider the principle of it, it leads you in the direction of thinking radically about changing the council tax back to a proportional tax on property, which would have all sorts of implications in terms of, for example, reducing the upward pressure on house prices and other things, which will contribute to reducing inequality in a number of different ways.
Thank you. I mean, one of the arguments you make in the taxation section is that you need to raise the marginal, as I understand it, is that you need to raise the marginal rates all the way up in terms of the not just looking at the top marginal tax rate. Would you recognise that people's concern about inequality may be more about the top than it is about those rather further down?
Well, the tax issue is an important one because it's not just about inequality. It's also about the fiscal sustainability of our country. And I think it's one has to recognise that actually we've been under-taxing ourselves for probably 20 or 30 years. And as a result of that, I think any honest assessment is going to be we have to raise taxes unless we're going to cut back on public services very dramatically. So taxes have to go up, and I think that means that taxes will probably rise for most people. And what I was concerned to do is to try and think of a way which distributes that in a way which is both fairer but also avoids some of the severe disincentives we face through the interaction of the tax and benefit system.
Particularly at the bottom of the income scale.
Yes, particularly at the bottom of the income scale. And that's why, for example, in the book I suggested that we should think about taxing the rich in the same way as we tax people at the bottom of the scale, and that the 65% effective tax rate, which is embodied in the proposals for universal credit, would be perhaps a reasonable standard to apply at the top as well as the bottom.
Right, effective tax rate there, meaning the withdrawal of means tested benefits, which of course operates on people in poverty as well as tax and national insurance contributions.
Exactly, I suppose one has the effect of those is exactly the same. Mm-hmm.
So we've been talking about taxation, and I wanted to bring you on to something else which could be seen as a fiscal principle, which is equity between people with and without children, which I think quite rightly you argue is not usually discussed and should be. So I just wondered if you could tell us about your proposal about child benefit.
I think it is important that one thinks about children as if it was home rights themselves and not as being some kind of lifestyle choice by parents, which is how they're sometimes discussed in the public debate. And for that reason, it seems to me that one should recognise that families with children are in need of having additional either tax allowances or the equivalent, in this case, of providing child benefit. Mm. And the Prime Minister should get child benefit just like anyone else with that number of children. So for me, that is a core of the redistributive system, which is not really redistribution, it's actually recognising the rights of the child.
Thank you. And as I say, I would very much agree with that principle and that it is a principle that's often neglected in public debate. Mm. On the social security, I mean, child benefit sort of straddles social security and tax in a way, as you've said, but on the social security side, you have proposals for either a renewed social insurance system or what you call participation income, which is a non-means-tested, unconditional payment to all adults. But in a sense, it would be conditional because it would be conditional on participating in society. I wonder which of those you think is more likely to be taken on board by politicians.
Well, I think in a way there is a clear choice. We've seen that successive governments, probably dating back to the 70s, have effectively taken the social security system in the direction of means testing. Mm. And it was a succession of moves which were reinforced under the Blair-Brown government to bring out the role of tax credits, which means now that a very large number of people in the country are receiving benefits which are income-related, one form or another. And my view is, and has been for a very long time, that the same view as that of Lord Beveridge, which was that we should provide benefits without tests of means. And the reasons for that are a combination of concern about the rates of implicit taxation involved in withdrawing benefits, but also the fact that it's still the case, after many years of trying, we have not succeeded in making sure these benefits reach everyone to whom they're entitled. And there are large numbers of people who don't get the tax credits to which they're entitled. So I think we have a choice, and the choice is to go in either of one of two directions. One is, I think, to return to a social insurance principle, which is, I think, very much people don't understand how important that principle can be, particularly when you get to discussions about entitlement of people in different countries and so on, or entitlement on the basis of past work records and a sense of fairness and entitlement. And so I think the social insurance alternative has really been whittled down to being a very restricted part, and as a result, many of the problems stem from that. Mm-hmm. And so that one way to go is that. The other way is to say, well, in fact, that is no longer really going to work in the kind of much more fluid labour markets we have, with much more mobility and so on, and to go for something along the lines of a citizen's income, although my preference is indeed not for, I don't think citizenship is actually exactly the right criterion, but something along those lines, which would be a radical alternative. Mm. And I think one could see either of the major political parties going in either direction.
Right, right. I wanted to go on to some of your proposals which are not tax and social security and about which I know less. And one of those would be what you say about technology, really, and the way in which technology shouldn't just be seen as something which is automatic and not under our control. But so what do you propose on what we do about technology and its social impact?
Well, the first point I'd like to stress is that it's very important to look at what determines incomes before the government taxes and transfers. I think it has begun to be discussed more, I think, that in the political debate. But that's, in my view, probably the more important part almost of a programme to reduce inequality, is to tackle inequality in the workplace and in capital incomes. And both of those are related to technology. I mean, I think that technology is almost certainly is affecting the distribution of wages, and it's also affecting the distribution between wages and capital. So both of those things are, I think, crucial. And one of the points I've tried to stress, which is not new with me, it's all been part of the economics literature for a long time, is that the way technology evolves is it reflects decisions and reflects economic forces. And these forces don't arrive from outer space. I mean, their decisions are made by companies, by individuals, by governments supporting research. For example, supporting programs of research and driverless cars will impact on the demand for taxi drivers.
You have a lovely image about whether we would want drones delivering meals on wheels. And that could be a possibility with technology, but we need to think about the social and employment implications if we go down that road.
Yes, the image about drones and meals on wheels was meant to dramatise a rather that's dry economic fact, which is, of course, most things we buy are actually a combination of things. That is, you don't just buy a meal, you buy the service that comes with it and the human contact. Mm-hmm. And in the case of Meals on Wheels, I think the human contact is a very important part of it. But I think it's true of many other services. I think that, and the question one has to ask is, who is it who decides whether, for example, you go into a shop and you just see a row of boxes from which you pick things and put your money in, or whether there's someone there to advise you and tell you what the product will do and whether it will suit your needs and all the other things. And these are, I think, rather fundamental concerns, which there's no guarantee that purely market decisions will lead to the right balance between these.
I can see exactly what you mean. you also talk about, in this area of what is sometimes called pre-distribution, about affecting gross incomes, market incomes before tax and social security. You also talk about the importance of countervailing power. And you also talk about a possible social and economic council, which could be set up. But in particular, I was struck by the idea of us having, if you like, more of a national conversation about pay and about rewards and about differential rewards for different things. And I just wondered how you envisage that working, and whether you saw that, as some people might, as a return to old-fashioned corporatism, or whether you were thinking about a sort of deliberative, participatory public dialogue of some kind.
Yes, I've certainly been accused of nostalgia for the 1970s, and I should perhaps have made clearer that I was envisaging something rather different. And I also should acknowledge that in some other European countries, these councils, in the case of Italy, have actually been abolished in recent times. And I think that reflects the fact that that was a structure which is somewhat outdated. And I certainly had in mind that it would involve a much wider participation than, for example, employers, trade unions, and government, which would be a tripartite form. But I think it goes back to the thought that there is actually a kind of conversation going on already, in the sense there's a lot of discussion about issues to do with whether it's right that CEOs should be paid so much. I mean, there are bodies which are researching this or campaigning on this. And I think that there's probably more activity of exploiting new technology and other things of people who are engaged in the kind of conversation already. So what I was really thinking was we could make this now more formal, give it actually some position in our non-constitution that we have, as in many countries is such a body is part of the constitution, and to ensure, for example, that there is consultation and that there is deliberation which engages people in their different roles they play, because I think that people are engaged as workers, as employers, and consumers all into all of these things for themselves in different ways.
And in fact, one of the points you make in the book is that it isn't just governments who make decisions, and the book is not just addressed to governments, it's also addressed to people as individuals who have influence in all those different ways as well, which I thought was a really important point.
Yes, I think we've seen that with sort of boycotts of certain companies and so on, and that I think is in a way asking people to think about how they're in their own lives they do. They do actually have some effect. I mean, and that's of course true both within the country and globally. And we see that, for example, in the it's not enormous, but quite substantial sums of money that go in private donations to international development.
I wanted to come on to education and training because just like predistribution is a term which has been much discussed in some political circles recently, so has social investment. And social investment has been taken to mean particularly investment in, I mean, it can be interpreted in lots of different ways, but it's been taken to mean investment in human capital in particular, and therefore in education and training. As one of those things from early education onwards. In your book, you don't place much emphasis, I think, on education and training. That's how I would see it, either in terms of explaining inequality or in terms of possible solutions to it. And I just wondered why that was.
Well, partly,
if I'm right.
No, I think it's a fair comment, but I think I did try and explain that this is investment in human capital has been very extensively discussed, and it's the standard response from everyone. I mean, every political leader, if you're the European Union, for example, has been talking about the need for smart growth and for investment in training and education, and it has had very extensive policies in that direction. But so in that sense, I was trying to focus on things people are not discussing.
Yes.
So it was not to go over the same ground again. I say quite clearly in the book that I strongly support that. But there are, I think, some questions we have to ask, and a sort of simple way of putting it, which I think goes back to the inequality of opportunity argument, is it's not quite clear people are distinguishing enough between investment in human capital, which equips people in ways that makes them more able to compete in the labour market, like, for example, teaching people to swim and giving them a swimming certificate, or whether it's going to change the way in which they compete in a swimming race. And these are different things. And I think that a lot of the inequality is actually about who gets what particular jobs, and that the levels of investment in human capital may just simply rearrange the people who get these jobs rather than have any effect on the final outcome. And I think one has to distinguish between these, and I think the policies become rather less clear.
That's very interesting. I wondered what you thought the implications were or the messages were of the recent election in the UK for the possibilities for elements of the package you suggest being implemented in the future. I know that you say that the book is a longer term message, but I just wondered whether you had any thoughts on the outcome of the election and the implications for inequality in the future in the UK.
One rather striking feature of the election was there was actually very little discussion of inequality. Mm. And I did check with the media coverage, and the number of sentences containing the word inequality did not significantly increase during the election campaign. Mm. So it was not, despite the Labour Party saying it was one of their concerns, it didn't feature very extensively. Mm. So I don't think we regard that as being a verdict on a campaign fought on that issue. And of course, one has also to remember that I think this government has the smallest number of proportion of popular vote of any government since the Second World War, including the minority Labour government. So there are 63% of the voters who didn't, in fact, support the present government's policies. But I think also the national government is an important actor, but we have other governments in this country. We have devolved governments, which are, interestingly, I think, more concerned about these issues. We have local governments. We have Europe-wide government, effectively. And the European Union, in recent years, has been much more concerned with these issues than the British government.
Yes, yes.
And we are still signed up to the Europe 2020 agenda, which is aiming to reduce, for example, poverty quite significantly. And in a sense, in the book, I was trying to say, well, there are ways we could do that.
Yes. And of course, the Prime Minister did say when he won that he was going to govern one nation. He did make that commitment. This is the result of research on economics since 1966, I think you say in the beginning of the book. But clearly the book can't reflect all your the range of your and the depth of your work on economics. It's very much aimed at a more general readership, I think you would say. So I just wondered what you're trying to achieve with that in terms of trying to reach a general readership. And also possibly whether you changed your mind since the 1960s on anything.
Well, one of the things that caused me to become an economist and to become concerned in this area was the publication of The Poor and the Poorest, Christmas Eve, 1965.
Five, I think.
Mm. So I can remember distinctly reading that. Mm. And I suppose throughout my career, I've been concerned both with trying to communicate and to develop ways of thinking about public policy and to make those more accessible to the general public, but also to talk to academic colleagues as well. And I think that's bridging those two is very important, because I think one of the problems has been the way in which economics in particular has gone in that period. And I've certainly, I think, my way of thinking about economics has tended to change. And one of the things I sort of tried to stress in the book is that many of the, what I call the conventional wisdom of why we can't do things and why there's a unfavourable trade-off between, for example, equity and efficiency is because of the kind of view people take as to how the economy works. And when you begin to take not sort of one departure, but a whole series of departures, many of which are the subject of mainstream research at the moment, if you bring them all together, and you then get a very different view of the world, and it's a view of the world in which there is considerable scope for making progress on both equity and efficiency. I think many of the inequities are actually very damaging to the economy in various ways. So I was trying to talk both to the general public to explain a little bit of what was going on, but also to my fellow academics to say, well, hang on, you ought to rethink.
So we've talked about you writing the book for a general readership and not just an academic readership. And that means that you're playing the role of a public intellectual, which you clearly have done throughout your academic life. What do you think about that role and how should universities place themselves in terms of the public debate?
Well, I think I would like to pay tribute to the fact that having been in a university over this time has allowed me both to pursue the areas of research which I felt were important, and I think that's a very it's very necessary to stress this, particularly at the present time, that I felt completely free. I don't think anyone was actually interested in the subject of inequality when I started working on it. I was encouraged by some of my senior colleagues, but it was purely my decision, and I was completely free to do this. And I think that freedom is an essential part of what a university is about. Mm. And then I think, equally, I think it is important that people should be able to convey that what the results of their research to a wider public, and of course, in doing that, to express their own views about how the world works and what can be done to change it in different directions. And so I think that's a fundamental aspect of universities, and I hope very much that won't be lost in the future.
Mm. I mean, that takes us on very well, I think, to I just wanted to quote a little bit from the book where you say you wrote it in a spirit of optimism. You said, "The world faces great problems, but collectively we are not helpless in the face of forces outside our control. The future is very much in our hands." So I kind of think the book is could be called Inequality, What is to be Done? Reasons to be Cheerful. And I just wanted to pay tribute to that, because your emphasis on learning from experience in the past, and also your stress on the importance of political agency for the future, both in terms of political will by governments and in terms of the influence of individuals, I think is incredibly important today. And I just wanted to say how delighted and honoured I am to have had the opportunity of discussing your book with you.
Thank you very much.